Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast. Today I'm joined by legendary comic book creator Jimmy Palmiotti. Jimmy has worked on several iconic characters and runs. He inked titles like The Punisher and Ghost Rider, and often inked the work of his friend and collaborator Joe Quesada. Together they created Ash and Painkiller Jane. He also worked on Daredevil, a run especially known for the Guardian Devil arc scripted by Kevin Smith. Jimmy is a great guest, and I had such a good time chatting with him. I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks.
Yes,
you got all done up for nothing. I do appreciate that.
Yeah, you know, I put on clean clothing, the whole thing.
Well, thank you for taking the time to do this today, Jimmy.
My pleasure.
So how is Tucson treating you this weekend?
So far, so good. The haven't gotten out yet. So I haven't left the hotel. I left the hotel for 5 minutes. I said, oh, it's hot, and I went back in. But no, it's been great. The people are really friendly. I can always tell when I haven't done a signing in a certain part of the country in a while. So everybody I'm meeting is saying, hey, last time I saw you was in in Albuquerque or this place or Phoenix, and 5 years ago, 8 years ago. So I'm reminded of all the work I've done since then, because they bring that to me to catch up with the signing. And
there you go.
But no, it's been great. People have been really sweet, and no complaints from me. I mean, the hosts are, friends. So Brian and Francesca, they're friends. So it's just been a really nice, pleasant weekend for Amanda and I.
Where do you come from?
I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
Lived there 45 years of my life. And then, like all good New Yorkers, we moved to the sixth borough of New York, which is Florida.
Yes, it is. Yeah, absolutely.
So I live down in Florida now. Actually, while I was here, because we did a convention the week before, in Colorado Springs, and then we took our time driving to here. We went to see the Grand Canyon, Monument Valley. We did all that while a hurricane was heading right towards our house. Oh, it was heading right towards our house. So it was a little stress for the first 2 days, having people come in my house and move some artwork around and some things around. But it just made landfall above us, like a good 20 miles above us. So my house is probably washed very well, I'm a little bit on a hill, so I'm sure the bottom of the hill in my town, it's probably had a nice amount of water. But when that happens, people drive up to where my house is and park their cars. So I probably had a whole bunch of cars in front of the house. But no, the neighbors told us at 8 a.m, everything's fine. And once I got the green light, my neighbor's a great guy. Even if a tree fell on my house, he'd probably just chop it up, seal the house, and probably fix it before I got home anyway, because he's that kind of guy. But it's part of living in Florida. I mean, we've been there, Man and I have been there maybe almost 18 years. We've had 3 or 4 hurricanes. The good news about hurricanes is they're coming way in advance.
True.
So you just sit there and you're like, okay, I can sandbag this door, and oh, it's going. The hurricane spinning east, and so we know which side of the house to kind of, and knock on wood, we haven't had any issues. So we've been there almost 20 years.
Wow.
Four hurricanes. No, what the hurricanes do is when you get the winds, it's a tropical storm, and hurricane is a matter of a couple of degrees.
Right.
So, they knock down the dead branches around the house, and there's some pickup to do, and if a neighbor has any issues, then everybody chips in and takes care of the house or houses them. But we've been very lucky, and we're near where we live. We have an Indian burial ground type of thing, and it's supposed to be a very protected place. And everybody thinks it has a lot to do why we don't get hit directly. So we'll keep testing that for the rest of my life till I'm dead. But we love it there.
Do you think that people start getting acclimated to that, where they start to, we've been through this for 20 years now, everybody on the news is screaming that I need to do something about this. You're like, nothing ever happens, we're fine.
Well,
do people still take it seriously? Or
I think for me, I take it seriously, and I do all the things I can do.
Right.
But we have a glass house, pretty much. So it's a mid-century modern glass house.
Wow.
So what we've done, which a lot of people don't do, is we've encouraged the trees around our house. So we have tons of trees, live oaks and stuff like that. So our house is like in this big baseball mitt type of situation where the house is in the middle and the tree. We even had trees run through the house and the decks and stuff.
Oh, beautiful.
So it's either going to rip our house off the ground and throw it into the sky, or it's going to survive. But I don't think I like Amanda's parents. Definitely, they've been through so many. They do the couple of things and they're like, yeah, we're going to watch TV. They do all the precautions, but it's very normal. Like, we're going to fill the freezer with bottles of water, and we're going to fill the fridge with this so we don't have to keep opening it when the electricity's out for a couple of days. Like, it's very common for them. And then, you know, we watch the news, because the news, you can't watch the Weather Channel because they like to make it like a story.
Of course.
And they also like to exaggerate a bit, which is okay because that needs to shake people up. But we watch local news because local news says, okay, the water's going to be up to here. Or we have a thing like evacuation A, B, and C. So our house is a C house. This past hurricane was an A.
Okay.
So evacuating A, that's when we know we're not really going to have any flooding. It's going to have to be like insane for us to get any flooding. So I think a lot of people, there's a lot of sense of, since we have a lot of people visiting from other places, vacationers, they either panic like mad or they go, well, I'll just stay in my hotel room. Nothing's going to happen. And then that's when there's chaos and that's when there's problems. But it's like any natural disaster. You have to kind of take it each one separately and look at it. This one we looked at because it went from being a tropical storm to four in a matter of no time.
Yeah.
And if four directly hit where my house was, we would have been told to evacuate because we would have been C or D. Four is just takes out the house. And yeah. And then we would have made sure we were somewhere else. But while the hurricane was going on, Amanda and I were looking at the Grand Canyon. And we're like, well, we're nowhere near each other. And I said, I have you, you have me. And, you know, that's all that matters to me in the end. The other stuff is just stuff. It's a house.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, we have enough friends. We can live and get back on our feet. But if she was there and I was here.
Different story.
Oh, I would have been a complete wreck. Yeah, I would have been beside myself. Because she's what's most important to me. So at the end of the day, if it's really bad, we blow out of there. We get out of there. We have a friend that has a house it's like a fort. Like, it has 6-inch glass, the whole craziness. He's paranoid about hurricanes. So he has this house that we run to. And of course, he loves it because it's company. So everybody's partying in the house while trees are blowing sideways outside. That was the last one. It was pretty rough. But his house, like, we didn't even know it was a hurricane outside unless we looked outside. Because his house is so
bunkered down.
He had it built like a bunker that could take up to 200 miles per hour winds. So the hurricane was just bouncing off the house. And we'd see palm trees that are like maybe 60, 70 feet tall, literally sideways like this.
No.
And then the hurricane slows down. They would go and go right back up. Kind of crazy.
That's a hard pass, man.
But you know, I lived in Brooklyn and we had all different things going. There you get shot, you know. So that, there's no warnings, just a random bullet.
Sure.
Also, we had a hurricane up there that pretty much wiped out Coney Island, parts of Coney Island and stuff. I just think that everywhere has its own little thing. And unless I built the house, I didn't build this house. If I built the house in Florida, it would be different than the one I'm in. Because the one I'm in, that people laugh. They're like, oh, you're doomed. And I'm like, well, I'm not even in the house when the hurricane goes. I leave.
Yeah.
So I'm not doomed. I said, the house is doomed. But, you know, you can rebuild a house.
So hurricane season is generally when you hit the road and do the concert?
It's true. Actually, we're going to Europe in the beginning of October. And hurricane season goes to like end of October, beginning of November. We just prep it. And it's funny because I have, you know, Amanda's art and stuff. We have them in the watertight suitcases and with addresses and everything. So if the house gets destroyed and these things blow down the road, they're made for instruments, like classical instruments.
Yeah.
So it has an address. We hope some honest person will find it and return it if that happens. At the end of the day, all you got is your health and stuff like that. So that's all that really matters.
So you mentioned before that you and Amanda, you have everything that you need.
Yes.
But if the house is blowing down, there's one object you can go in and get. What's that object?
Besides Amanda, you mean?
Besides Amanda. Okay. Amanda's in good.
And one object. My brain is running through the house right now, looking. I probably take, I have a safe with all our records and birth certificates. And is a Florida, very Florida thing. A lot of our photos are in our dishwasher.
Excuse me?
So when a hurricane comes, we put the photos in the dishwasher because it's sealed. It's a waterproof seal.
That's amazing.
So we put it in the dishwasher. Dishwasher's shoved in the kitchen. The last thing that's going to rattle, that's a hard thing to move because it weighs a ton. So we put all the photos in the dishwasher. So I'd probably go for the photos and records and stuff like that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because it's, you know, baby pictures and stuff. But to say, I will go backwards and say I have scanned almost all of them. So if we lose them, I have them on different places. Yeah.
I could not store anything in the dishwasher. I know that I would turn that thing on automatically. I'd be leaving the house, evacuating. I would turn on the dishwasher by accident, walking out the
door. While you were evacuating, you would turn the dishwasher on?
I don't know. My dishwasher turns on automatically when you close it.
Okay. You can pull the plug, though.
That's true.
So you just pull the plug, and it is a sealed waterproof. Of course, brilliant. It's waterproof, right?
Yeah,
it's the most waterproof thing in the house is the dishwasher. I don't know. I read that online somewhere. That somebody did it, and I was like, that's pretty brilliant.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Because water can't get in, water can't get out.
That's great. Yeah. So, okay. You and Amanda on the road doing this all the time. How does that work for you? Because it's me and my wife. I've been together 14 years now, and she's the person that I want to see every day more than anybody in the world. I get that. I work from home.
Right.
So, but for a lot of people, they need that separation and distance.
We do have separation. She's on the upstairs, and my studio's downstairs. So we meet for lunch. Like, so Amanda is like a hyper focused artist. Mm-hmm. So when she's drawing, I can't interrupt it. Cause if I interrupt it, that means she's shut down for an hour or two. So I leave her alone when she's drawing, except for food. Like I'll notice it's 3:00. I'm like, sweetheart, we have to go get something to eat or I'll make you some lunch. But I leave her alone and she leaves me alone. And she knows when I'm in work mode, because I usually have classical music on while I'm writing. So she knows that that's my time to focus. But, you know, we're like that weird couple that feels we'd never get enough time for each other. So when we're away, we're having the best time. Like even doing these two conventions, the time before, you know, we went to another part of Grand Canyon we haven't been to. We went glamping, you know, we went camping and, you know, we love spending time with each other. And, you know, we got married later in life. You know, we met and we got married later in life. And I think we both understood how special it was that we met and we connected and we fell in love with each other, and how rare that was, that we had like minds that were completely different at the same time, but we have very like minds for
sure.
A lot of things. So we've just been lucky. But as far as the work, you know, we work together a lot, and then when we're not working together, we are critical of each other's work. So we help each other out. And even though at times we can argue, it's sort of like a sweet argument. You know, it's like, I know she has a point and she knows I have a point.
We want to make each
other's
art.
But we may not want to hear it, but we, So it's a good relationship and we're always trying to push the other person. You know, it's never about, I don't care about fame and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
I learned early on that that's just a problem. So we're always trying to promote each other, others' work. And in the end, we just want to, honestly, we want to just have time together, work and play and have fun. And, as we get older, we realize, that's even, you know, it becomes less and less time.
So. It's not nearly enough time. It's so weird. It feels like when you're younger, it feels like there's nothing but time in the world. And in fact, you feel the excess of time where there's a pressure of too much time.
The dead quiet. And, like we should do this or we should. Man and I don't have a we should do this. We say, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
You know, and even like she loves Europe, so we're going to just travel around Europe and do stuff. But we're very spontaneous with that kind of stuff. But we also know, you know, you can be obsessed with your career and that could be everything to you. But that's a joke, right? Because we make comics, we tell stories. You know, I do things in different mediums and stuff like that. And it's great, and I love the people that love it, and my Kickstarters, I have interact with them. But at the end of the day, I also know what's more important. You know. And if I'm not healthy and happy, then it's going to reflect in my work in some way, whether it's darker or whether it's just less work. You know, there's a lot of different ways that can translate. So our goal is to keep each other happy and entertained. And if we're not happy, or if we have issues, we just drag them into the light and we talk them out. And then they're no longer scary anymore. Yeah. That's a thing couples need to learn over the years. And we've had some therapy that helped us with that, but it definitely is really important to deal with that elephant in the room right away.
I love the way you frame it. Putting light on it. It kills it. It's the monsters in the closet. They're not scary when you pull them out. You realize they're much smaller than you thought they were.
Yeah. And it's silly stuff too, because in your brain, you're doubling it and tripling it as far as intensity, or I really say what's on my mind. It's really going to make a mess, and she's not going to want to talk to me for a week.
Yeah.
And then the reality is, if you sincerely just say, hey, look, you know, this is what I like, or this is what I don't like, or here, can we work on this? It's usually like a relief to the other person. Like, good, because I've been noticing the weight on you,
yeah,
and you're not telling me about it. And it's really interesting how we create a lot of our own problems.
Yes.
Because we're thinking that it's going to be a problem for the other person. And I think of her, there's nothing she can tell me that I'm not going to want to work out with her.
It's true.
And, you know, yeah, I may not like to hear it, but again, there's nothing there that I won't work out with her, because that's part of being in love, is being patient with and understanding with the other person.
Well, and you find out that there's a lot of times either the person is on the same page that you are,
yes,
and they're not expressing it, or they don't even give a shit. They say something, they're like, oh, I don't care, so I'll default to you, whatever you want to do. And that's
the worst one, right? Because, you know, we have it built up. And then, like, I tell her, you know, I'm so self-conscious about losing hair in the back. I'm 62. And she's like, I don't care. You know, she's like, and I tell her, you know, I want to shave my head. I want to go full Bruce Willis, Die Hard. And she's like, don't you dare. And I'm just like, okay, you know. So, yeah, I think I wish more people were like that. But we all have these things we grew up with that keep us kind of keep things in the dark with people. And the world would be a lot easier. That's why I don't buy into media trying to play us against each other, right? Because media, news, and TV,
sure,
they want to play us against each other. And then it gets us angry and riled up. And then we start buying into a side, picking a side. And then those people are promoting that side to get more of our money and attention. And the reality is, if we take politics out of it, and again, you're in a hurricane, your neighbors are usually like, hey, you guys need help, or can we help you in some way? There's always my buddy with his saw going around. You need a branch taken down.
Yeah.
He doesn't give a shit about politics. They don't care about anything. It's like helping people.
Oh, and hurricanes don't know politics. They don't.
They don't. And so I look at comics that way. Like, people go, oh, comics are political. And I'm like, no, everything's political. It's your choice to make it more political. I said, I wrote a strip called Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters with Justin Gray.
Yeah.
And people kept going, oh, so that's what you think. And I'm like, no, that's what Uncle Sam thinks. That's what Black Condor thinks. I'm a writer. I have to look at everything from the point of view of the characters, so they have individual voices. I said, if you want to know what I think, just ask me. I said, but my characters, I am not my characters. My characters are individuals, and they have different opinions than me.
Isn't that a great way to find empathy for other people, to try on a character that has different beliefs than you and try to humanize that?
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult for people.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to demonize somebody than to deal with their reality.
Mm.
Right? It's easier. Somebody tells you they have cancer, they have this and that, you know, it's heavy.
Sure.
And you can empathize, or you can run away from it. And our society is taught about we become a people where we watch a video that's 40 seconds long, and we're almost teary-eyed that it's this dog hasn't seen his master in 3 years.
Sure.
And the dog runs over, and it's like, and we're like, oh, we feel so good. We're almost crying. And then the next video is a girl on a jumping rope with a big chest. And we're like, okay. And we're like, we don't even, everything's jammed so quick.
Yeah.
There's no processing. So, so I think that lack of processing of things, or we watch a film, we'll watch a film that really involves us. And then the next 10 minutes, we're like, well, what are we eating for dinner? And we're fighting about where we're going. So
yeah.
I think we're in a society where nothing sits for very long. So again, it cheapens everything. And when things are cheapened, that means connections are weakened.
True.
And over time, weakened connections makes it so you have snap judgments. Snap judgments lead to no empathy or understanding. And then we have a bunch of people that are angry, and they don't even know why they're angry. They're just angry, you know. Well, all of a sudden, it's easy to point a guy and go, oh, that guy over there selling fruit at the red light, get a job, instead of going, boy, that poor guy has, you know, he's got to stand in the middle of the street with this what's his story? He started out as a sweet kid, and at some point, everything went wrong. Should I be yelling at him, or should I be like talking to him and saying, how can we help?
I think defaulting to empathy and understanding is probably a muscle that we should all work on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I have it. Amanda and I have it very fine tuned. Like, people come up to the booth, we could tell they have issues. They have weight on their shoulders. Our Harley run had, you know, the thing when we did Harley Quinn was we had to step away from an abusive relationship. Yep. And we still have people, even this past weekend, where girls come going, you know, I read your book and I decided to change my life, and they're crying. And of course, Amanda's hugging them and, you know, all that stuff. And yeah, it's sweet and it's wild to think that something we wrote changed somebody's life so much. It's like a superpower. And it's a feel good thing for us, definitely. But it's also nice to understand that something you do has a positive effect.
Well, I think it's such a beautiful idea, taking that story that people were familiar with and adding this layer to it of the toxic relationship and what that, something that was right there on the surface the whole time that had never really been explored in that way though.
It was funny because when the book was offered to us, you know, they just wanted us to do more Harley, right?
Yeah.
And it already got canceled before. And the end of the deal was the editor, and he goes, what are you guys going to do? And I said, I can't write a comic about a woman in an abusive relationship. How do I start with that without her kicking his ass right away?
Yeah.
And Amanda says, yeah, no, I'd rather see who she is. Like, who is she? And so we talked for a while, and we said, well, we have to take her out of Gotham, because everybody in Gotham is a secondary character to Batman.
Yep.
Right? It's Batman's universe. And, you know, Paul Dini and Bruce Timm, when they created the character was from Brooklyn. I said, well, you know what? I'm going to put her back in Brooklyn, but I'm going to put her in Coney Island because she's got the clown type thing. And she'll just blend there. I know Coney Island. Nobody will even blink with that girl walking around.
Yeah.
And I said, let's give her a supporting characters that like her and understand her. And let's not worry about the supervillains and the Batman and Joker. She's leaving the Joker, right? So who cares about them? They're in 17 other comics.
Yeah.
Let's give this girl her own life. And Amanda goes right away. She goes, well, no woman wears the same outfit, so I'm going to change her outfits all the time. And DC said, look, do whatever you want. It's only going to last 6 issues or 8 issues. So it'll probably get canceled. So you guys do whatever you want. Well, sometimes in comics, the right people on the right character, right? Amanda and I were in a place, we co-wrote it together. And of course, we're seeing things about her. Like, well, would you do that? I wouldn't do that. Well, let's create this. We have a burlesque/freak show type thing where she lives in that building. And I'm like, of course, because she's going to relate to outsiders.
Yep.
Like herself, and let's create an environment where she doesn't feel in Gotham. She felt like she had to stay with the Joker, be a bad guy, fight the Batman. And she was torn. That character was torn. I said, let's take her somewhere new, sort of like you leave your high school and go to a college in another state. I can redefine who I am now.
None of the baggage is
in this new school. Yeah. None of the baggage is there. None of the expectations are there. So we said, let's bring her to Brooklyn and what would she do? And Amanda says, well, she'd be trying to help people. Because that initially she was a doctor, and you know that never left her. So, and nobody becomes a doctor of anything and doesn't want to help people. So we cued in on, you know, okay, this is who she is. And then who are the people around her? What kind of people would be attracted to being around her? And she had a positive energy. And then I took, like, because Amanda's obsessed with food, so I made Harley obsessed with food. Amanda's an animal person. Of course, Harley loves animals.
Sure.
And we built the character in a different way. And, you know, we talked to Paul Dini and Bruce, and they loved what we were doing. So it was like we got their blessing. And then, of course, would she have relationship? Of course she would, but she also would have relationship. She's a person that deals with the heart. And I had a...
This episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So today, I went into Bookmans and decided to try to find a film by Michael Mann. I went over to the Blu-ray section and saw copies of several films I already own, and then I found it, Black Hat. This is one I haven't seen in quite a while since it came out, and I figured maybe it was time for a reassessment of this much maligned film. So Black Hat is a cybercrime thriller directed by Michael Mann that delves into the world of cybercrime, hacking, and international intrigue. While it promises to be a gripping exploration of the dangers lurking in the digital age, the execution falls short of expectations. The film follows convicted hacker played by Chris Hemsworth, who's temporarily released from prison to help the American and Chinese authorities track down a criminal network that's responsible for a series of major attacks. As the hunt takes them across the globe, Hemsworth's character must navigate the murky waters of the criminal underworld while grappling with his own demons. One of the film's major shortcomings is its lack of technical accuracy and realism. While it attempts to portray the world of hacking authentically, it often falls into cliches and inaccuracies that ultimately undermine the credibility of the story. So the hacking sequences are exaggerated and unrealistic, relying more on flashy visuals than genuine technical expertise. And this is coming from an absolute layman. I am not somebody who knows anything about hacking, and yet I can see some of the things that just flat out aren't true in this film. And that particular disconnect may disappoint viewers familiar with the subject matter or looking for a more grounded portrayal of cybercrime. So despite these flaws though, Black Hat does have its moments. Michael Mann's signature style is evident in the film's beautiful, sleek cinematography and the signature action sequences, and the international setting adds depth to the narrative. It highlights the global nature of cyber threats and the challenges of international cooperation. Chris Hemsworth delivers a solid performance as Hathaway, bringing the character a sense of depth who's grappling for redemption. And the supporting cast includes, had no idea, I'd completely forgotten this, but Viola Davis, who's really great in the film and adds a lot to the film. But ultimately, Black Hat falls short of its potential. While it offers a glimpse into the world of cybercrime and espionage, its lack of technical accuracy and reliance on cliches detracts from the overall experience. And despite its flaws, fans of Michael Mann's work or of the cyber thriller genre, I guess if you're a huge Johnny Mnemonic fan and you're looking for some more cyber thriller, you could do worse than Black Hat. However, for those seeking a more realistic, nuanced exploration of hacking and cybersecurity, this might leave you wanting more, and I'm not sure I can recommend this one. But despite that, this gave me the chance to check out a film that I've been meaning to reevaluate, because I keep hearing that Black Hat is an underrated film, and maybe I'll give it another 10 years, follow back up with this one, and see if it does end up coming around for me. But remember, Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks.
I have a friend that's bisexual, and she explained to me, she said, you know, I don't fall in love with the sex of a person. I fall in love with the person. And she says, so if they're male or female, that's secondary to me. She goes, it's just the person. It's so rare that I fall in love anyway. So when I fall in love with somebody, it's about them. It's not about the sexuality. Yep. And I said, okay, let's apply this to Harley in a way.
Yeah.
And that's where Ivy came from. And, you know, the characters are there.
This is what's so brilliant about that. The best ideas are the ones that seem obvious. They're not easy to get to, but you're like, oh, no. It was lying there the whole time. This just makes sense.
I mean, they could look, Dini and Tim created a brilliant character.
Yeah.
And it was a multi-layered character when they created it, but she was in that spot all the time.
Right.
But they even covered, they teased it, the sexuality. They did what they could with the character as far as they could. And we pushed it as far as we could. And then when we got out, of course, I always said, and you may not know the reference, you may understand it, may not, but I did the moonlight lighting thing.
Of course.
I never connected.
Civil Shepherd and
I never had them connect. I always had the will it, won't it, maybe one day. As soon as we left the book, bang, got together. That they put it right back in Gotham. From our run, a couple of things happened, right? The movies happened.
Yep.
And Margot was a huge fan of the books we did, and she would take pictures of her reading our trade books and at airports and stuff, which we love her for. We met her like 3 or 4 times. She's been amazing. But she modeled that Harley after, you know, the books we did. And so that was very sad. And then they did the animated series, which took our series
yep.
But they did the thing, which I was like, okay, they put it right back in Gotham. And I get it because it's animation. They want to get as many people as they can. But the comics went right back to Gotham. And, you know, I had a recent conversation with someone up there. And I said, they said, you know, it just doesn't sell the same when you did it. You guys did it. And I said, you know why? We did 100 and something issues of continuity. It was one story.
Yeah.
You guys are telling 100 separate stories. And so it doesn't have the weight anymore because it's this person's point of view, that person's point of view. I said, when the fans read ours, there was a continuity. Even with the specials, they were all in a sequential continuity because mm-hmm. Amanda and I wrote it in a solid run. We didn't have a break. 5 years worth. A lot of books, three That's omnibuses plus, yeah. right? But I said, but I'm a comic fan and I'm the guy that wants Fantastic Four number one to 180 because I know it was the same team, same guy writing it, whatever. I like the continuity of comics. That's the unique thing about it. Why we like cable shows where it's season one, two, and three is because there's a continuity of characters. Yeah. But if you did, let's just say Sopranos and they were all done in one stories, it wouldn't have the weight.
Yeah.
And any show, let's pick any show, Yellowstone, any show that's popular. If you did it where it was just separate stories, Yellowstone, this story, Yellowstone, it would lose some of it, sort of like what Star Wars is going through in a way.
Very true.
And sort of what, you know, so anything like that, when they start breaking it up, it's not like you lose the audience, but I do have people that go, well, I don't watch Star Wars anymore because there's just so many stories. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
But they love the first three movies.
Sure.
Right? So with Harley, that was our thing. When we did Harley, she was the only other book we let DC put her in where we didn't have anything to do with it was Suicide Squad because okay. she was a different character in there. Our book, we mentioned that she took the bomb out of her neck. So we always said our book is a future, is Harley's future. Suicide Squad is happening when it's happening.
Yeah.
But when it had this initial success, DC wanted to start doing all these side books with Harley because they wanted to make more money off what we were doing. And I said, you can't do it unless we do it. And I told Dan, I said, if we don't do it, it's not the same. And we're going to lose something. And, you know, and he said, you know, you're probably right, but I need these annuals and I need side books. So we wrote all of them.
Really?
All of them. Every annual, every side book, Gang of Harleys, Power Girl Harley Quinn, yeah. Harley Quinn's Little Black Book. Man and I wrote all of them. So why is it were they so successful? Because it was complete continuity. As the books came out, you felt you could have mapped out everywhere they went and what they did, and we referenced old stuff. And there was no dropout. Now, people say, well, does that allow for new readers? And I said, yeah, because they collect all the trades. New readers can catch up.
Yep.
When they did Rebirth, Harley Quinn was the only book that didn't start new. We just, so Harley Quinn.
Really?
Yeah, Harley Quinn.
When they did the 52, the switch
yeah.
over?
Yeah. So we switched over. Harley Quinn was just the next day. We didn't change it. We have to stay the same. I said, it's your best-selling book. Why would we change it? And he goes, I'll make an exception with this book. So we kept the continuity. Got a new number one out of it.
Sure.
And we did. In the first couple of pages, we brought people up to date what was happening. And then, boom, went into the story. So, again, sometimes the right creators on the right books. But I've been reading comics long enough to know that this is how to do it. And right now, the companies are not doing, they're not paying attention right now. They're worrying about five different covers and less about the content inside.
That's a shame.
Yeah, but they'll learn. They'll have a hit and then they'll dissect it and they'll figure it out. You know, we have to understand, it's the reason I do the Kickstarter is because I directly sell my books to people.
Yeah.
They know there's a quality there. What the companies do is they look at, that guy's been writing there for a while. Let's get rid of him. Let's find somebody cheaper. Let's find a cheaper artist. And they don't understand that these are diehard fans. They want the creators they want. They don't get it.
You follow your creator.
I follow every one of my creators.
Yeah.
I buy anything the Hernandez brothers do.
Yeah.
Anything. I follow them no matter who they're working for. It doesn't matter to me. It's like saying I don't want to watch this movie because it's Paramount. That's like the most ridiculous thing. But people follow actors.
Oh, yeah.
They have their favorite act. They follow genres, but they do follow actors like crazy. And comic companies haven't learned that yet.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
Because I don't mind, and comic books taught me this, you can have a different creator spin on something. That's fine.
Sure.
Like, let's go ahead and have a Star Wars that's done by somebody that wants to do the low budget, micro budget sci-fi version of it. That's like essentially just a talking piece with two people in a room, but it's Star Wars. Cool. Do that. Somebody wants to do a broad comedy out of it. Great.
Right.
Like, that's all fine to me because of comic books, but you have to have creators with continuity within that, because when you do that, then it's just too much of it's shifting from fourth to second. It just doesn't work.
The big two have learned that pushing creators makes them more popular, and then they eventually leave because they don't want to pay them more. Okay. So they don't push great. Look, let's look at Disney. Let's take Disney as a great example. Name a Disney animated film where you can name a director, a writer, or anybody involved with any of the films.
With the exception of Brad Bird.
Except for Brad Bird. Brad Bird made a name for himself before it.
Yep.
With the exception of him, tell me a Disney animated film that you say, oh, you know, Chris Sanders created it. Now, Chris, the only guy I know, right? But I know plenty of them. But they don't. There's no investment in promoting.
That's not the general public, though.
No, it's not the general public. And they have no, they don't want to promote them because they don't want to pay them more. But the joke is, these certain people have fans like crazy, and people, but Disney does everything. And big corporations do that because they don't want to pay their people more. When you have a Tom Cruise, there's a power there.
There's a brand.
He has power.
Yeah.
He can literally make or break something. People will write things exact for him. And he's a really, whether you like him or not, the guy knows how to choose a movie.
True.
And he does not choose crappy movie. He chooses something that's made for him, that works for him. So comics, we've learned with Brian Polito and Billy Tucci and us, we've learned that we have an audience. We can kickstart a book. They'll come and buy our stuff no matter what it is, because they know what they're going to get. They're going to get something that they like. And, and I think that's the future of the business. It's going to take a little time. But I think that's the future of the business.
I could not disagree with you more.
Yeah. I'm joking. You can disagree with me all you want.
I'm joking. Okay. I agree 100%. It's literally the thing that I say on here all the time when I'm talking to people. Sorry, it was just, it's, yes, absolutely. You have to invest in the creators, because that's where that matters. It's built on that. It's the association is not with the IP model and following that. It's not the Marvel. It's not the DC. It's the what you're doing with that. It's a part of it.
Yeah, the movies are doing their own thing. Yeah. So it used to be we did things in the comics and then the movies copied it.
Oh,
now you've got creators that are following the movie and putting it into the comic. And I'm like, nope, bad. I said, we're the ones that come up with the crazy stuff. And then they pick and choose what they want. Now you flip it the other way, you lose your audience, because you know what? They can get the movie. They don't need a comic. Right. They get the movies. Movies come out every 2-3 months. There's another superhero movie out. See? Yeah.
Comic books have the ability to be anything.
Yes.
They're limitless in their scope and what they can do with it. You can tell any story you want to within a comic book in theory. And so movies have very real limitations to them.
They have screenplays are a three act. They're three acts. I mean, I write screenplays.
Yeah.
You know, I've had to get other people's screenplay and put a third act because they forgot to do it into it. But they're a model. The animated movies are exactly a model. They go by an actual chart. I remember I was up at DreamWorks and they showed me the flow chart for an animated feature.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, look at that. And I said, what if it breaks the chart a little bit? You know, people used to tell me when you're going to screenwrite, because I took screenwriting classes and I've done a bunch of screenplays. They used to tell me, you know, you can't break that mode. And I said, no. I said, actually, you can, because I have a story sensibility, but I just, old movies, remember, I'm going to go jump in a little sideways here.
Please.
Old movies, used to watch them, and then something would be resolved, and we'd go, the end, really quick. I don't know if you noticed that, 40s, 50s.
Yep. I'm a big noir guy, so
okay,
yes.
Okay, yeah, so noir is like the guy is dead, the street, the girl's crying. There's no afterwhere. You see her life. No, okay. As we got older, as film started learning, we understood there's a beat to an ending, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then let's take it even further. Let's look at Shawshank. It gives us four endings, but it's satisfying as hell.
Oh, each one of them
because
better than
they dropped
before.
The pen in the beginning and they picked it up at the end. And it's a movie you can watch over and over because they learn how to end it. Schindler's List has an ending. It has a big drawn out. It ends and then it ends again and it ends again because it's making a point. When things don't end right, no matter how good it was, we leave the place and go, that didn't feel right. The movie could be fantastic for an hour and 10 minutes, but the last 10 minutes, then you don't like the movie anymore. So it's important So comics have a beat as well. We have 22 pages or 20 pages
sure.
to deliver either a good cliffhanger or an ending.
Yep.
And I just think a lot of we're losing that craft a little bit on some level. People say, hey, read my book, and I read it, and I always go, yeah, okay, you know. And I always say, why yell at people? I'm like, you know what the budget is on this comic? $8 gazillion. I could do anything. It's in a movie, you know, CGI, sure, you can do most anything. But we also, because there's so much CGI, we've lost a sense of visceral, the visceral feeling that this matters. Or this guy. When you end every Marvel movie with a giant ship landing on a city,
yes.
Then you, after a while, you're like, well, I wonder how they're going to do this city. Like, you don't even care. Like, you see a building blow up and there's a million people fall out of it. There's no connection. But meanwhile, I can watch another movie where it's two people in a room and a girl's hanging out the window. And you're like, oh, my God, pull her in. Like, get her out of there.
Well, go back to the moonlighting. The tension right. of that is the will they, won't they.
Right.
That's all you need.
Yeah, and it's a simple thing. And it's like regular life. You know, it's like think of any relationship you've had where it's right before the relationship is consummated on some level. That there is, you're feeling the other person out
sure.
over dinner. You're going to a movie. You don't know if you should talk. I don't know if I should hold her hand or not. There's like so much there that's interesting. But when you connect them, then you have to figure out another set of rules for that relationship. And that's storytelling as well. But you can't just have them be together all the time and not have any, you know. And so that's where the fan aspect of writing comes in, where they want to see. It's not what I want to entertain the audience with. It's what I want to see them do. So there's a difference between I want to write Batman because I want to be Batman and I want to do this, or I want to write Batman because I want Batman to know what it's like to live on this block in my town.
That's taking Batman in a direction. You have a story, an
right.
idea that you want to express
right.
through Batman, not
right.
that I just want to try on that suit for an hour.
Right. And Chris Claremont like managed to do both with X-Men, right? Had X-Men have these adventures, and at the same time, the X-Men went to the shopping mall.
Yeah.
And it was just as much fun. He had a fantastic balance.
Agreed. Yeah, it was a soap opera take on
it.
It was
a soap opera, but it was fantastic balance because we gave a crap about them. We liked these people.
Yep.
And we wanted to see Storm drink a milkshake for the first time. And we wanted to see her reaction because she never had one.
Yeah.
And it's that sense of, associating our own lives with that is great. But at the same time, she has to be Storm.
Yep.
And so I think it's very important. I think the other problem with comics now is a lot of people write them because they think they're going to sell them for a movie or TV show. This whole company set up for that. It's all garbage.
Yep.
Okay. Because if you write a comic and you're thinking about a budget, you're not writing a comic. If you're thinking about how it's going to translate as a film. I wrote a book called Random Acts of Violence with Justin Gray. It was a horror comic we did for Image. And Jay Baruchel bought the rights,
yep.
and Jay made the movie, and we were on set, and I was on set with Amanda, and Jay said, you know, here's the latest screenplay. He goes, I changed some stuff, and he's like, I'm really nervous about you, what you think it is. And I said, I think it's great. And he goes,
he's not called a filmmaker, actually.
Yeah, he's terrific.
That's what he's doing.
He's a great guy, too. This is great. Loves comics, right?
Yeah.
So I said to him, I said, look, no matter what you do, you can still buy my book. There's my story. I said, so I'm not going to be precious about it with you because that's your vision of my story. And he was like, I am so relieved. He goes, we have 22 producers on this film and you're the only one here and you're the only one I care about. And I'm like, no, go
great.
Crazy. Do your thing, man. I said, if it's great, it's great. If it isn't, it isn't. But I said, it's your vision. I said, I already told my story. So no issues.
It's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. But a lot of the people, they're trying to, a lot of these companies pop up. You can smell it. They're trying to get a movie deal. They
yep.
bring an actor in to write some of the book. They're trying to sell it as a film deal. They're trying to get some. Okay, that's great. But that's not the comics I buy because I know it's like, it's a pitch. And the problem with the pitches are there's limitations to the comic.
Yep.
And once I see that, I don't want to read it.
You triggered something like, couple minutes into our conversation.
Okay.
It's been running around the back of my head. Were you a Charles Bukowski guy growing up?
I read his stuff and there's a million sayings and quotes from him that are great. I won't say his lifestyle was mine.
No, that's what it was. Because
yeah.
it was the idea you were talking about writing to classical music. And that was something
right.
that he always wrote about, you know, listening to classical music. He always wrote to that. But then it was that his lifestyle was something I never wanted to.
The greatest thing we have is that we can listen to other people's stories without having to go through them.
Yeah.
And so when I was younger in Brooklyn, I used to go to this bar called Floods. Okay. And it was, you know, I was like 16. I think the drinking age was 16 at the time. But I used to go there because it was dollar beers, right?
Sure.
Now, in Floods was like Joe Flood ran the bar. And there was like all these old men in there. And I was a kid, you know, but I would go in because it was cheap. And it was something to do. And they had pinball machines in there. And all these guys did was tell war stories. And they used to go, hey, Jimmy, come here. Look, I would tell you about the time I had to do this. And I would listen. And I'd be like, oh, my God, it's crazy, you know. And my imagination would run wild. And, you know, I had a couple of friends that were actual mobsters, which, you know, it's unfortunate for their lives. But they had stories. And
of course.
And my dad, I grew up, my dad's like, you'd be nice to everybody. But you don't want that life. He says, that's a bad life. My dad had a little paint store in New York, in Manhattan, Upper West Side. And he's like, and I'd have like some of these families, they're like, you know, very connected. And they'd tell me, hey, can you tell your father, Tony, to get us 2 gallons of paint? And I get it. My dad would say, don't take money from them, but don't linger. Bring the paint, say thank you, Mr. Whatever, and move on. So it was an interesting childhood. But all the stories, I've heard all the crazy stories. And I'm like, that's the material of my life right there. And again, Amanda and I also, we're big travelers.
Mm-hmm.
So we go to a town, we look into the history. I usually buy a book and read it while I'm hanging there.
Sure.
And we look at the history. We want to know everything about it because there's a million stories. When people tell me they have and Bukowski, of course, was all about his life. This is my experience.
Yep.
It's messed up. I left my door open. I went in the wrong apartment. I did all this crazy stuff. And he's not ever telling anyone to do what he does.
Oh, he never said, there's no romanticism in
it. No, but there's great pieces in there. There's great stuff. And, you know, when you do this for a living, you want to surprise the reader. You don't want to give them the Batman vs. Joker story. I've been offered every top book and I always laugh. I'm like, well, I recently had a conversation where they asked me about doing a Batman book, and I said, I would love to do a Bruce Wayne book, just about Bruce Wayne. Like, well, but you have to have Batman. I said, it'll be in there. But I said, but I want to know about, you know, how does he hire his escorts, you know, when he goes to the, not sex escorts, but, you know, the women he goes with to these events. How does he hire them? Does Alfred and him interview them? And I said, I want to know, like, what does he do that, like, what satisfies him when he's not Batman? And they're looking at me like I'm crazy. And I'm just like, well, I said, I've read everything else. You know, how many times are you going to fight the Joker and not kill him? And, you know, but I also realized I shouldn't be writing that. And that's what I realized.
Sure.
It's easier for me to write Harley because she's a little unhinged and a little fun and unpredictable. And in the comic, Amanda and I would say, you know, we know Brooklyn. So when we'd have her running down a street, I had her running down the boardwalk and to Brighton Beach. And I said, well, she would pass the aquarium. And Amanda goes, how could she resist going in the aquarium? And I said, ooh, let's have her go over the wall. And one of the books, she goes over the wall and she jumps in the whale tank and is trying to hug the whale, the beluga whale. They have a beluga whale in there. And I said, it's because we're in that place. We're able to write that. And how many people said, oh, I love that scene where she breaks into the aquarium and hugs the beluga whale, just random.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's what she would do, right? But it's also, I know the place. We're in there. So it's interesting how that kind of works.
Well, it's sometimes authenticity is really strange because you don't have to experience something to know that something's authentic. When you hear a story or you see a scene, you're like, oh, this is lived in. This is organic. This feels real. And those kinds of touches like that, that are of that world, you don't have to know anything about Brighton Beach to know that that is accurate.
Yeah, no, I wrote 105 issues of Jonah Hex. I was never, I did not grow up in the 1860s. I grew up in Brooklyn. I remember I did an interview for, I think it was True West magazine, and the guy heard my voice on the phone. He's like, wait a minute, where are you from? And I'm like, I said, Brooklyn. He goes, oh, don't break my heart. And I'm like, what? And he goes, well, I read these stories. They're so authentic. I'm like, it's called research. And I said, and I actually did go to a friend's ranch, and, you know, and I went and learned horseback riding. I said, I did these things just for me. I said, but, you know, I said, sometimes when you're writing about outer space, you really haven't been there.
Yeah.
But it's always the stuff we can relate to in that story, even though it's in outer space, that makes it interesting. So well,
it's the first time you get on a horse and whatever the leather smelled like and the way that it felt. And there's like details that you pick up in that.
Horses experience. Will kill you.
Yeah.
That's what I learned. Horses either like you or they don't. I remember I was training. I was getting taught how to ride, and I had one horse, and it had a name. I can't remember, like Penny or Candy, really sweet name. It was not a sweet horse. It was gigantic. And when I was done, I had to clean it to, you know, and then I had to brush it. And so every day I would bring peppermints to it so it would like me. Because somebody taught me, bring a little peppermint candy. I love peppermint candies. Bring a peppermint so the horse would like me. But that horse still didn't like, right? But Amanda walked up to the horse and it starts nuzzling. And she jumps on it and rides it up the hill. And I'm like,
that's it.
And I'm like, that, you know, okay. That's reality, man.
That's amazing.
You can't buy your way into a horse. That's what I learned, maybe. But anyway, you know, that's the adventure of it all. And you try to work your life into the work.
That's it shows, and that's why you've had the career that you've had and continue to have it. There's authenticity in it, man. So.
Yeah, it's craziness in there. And some of the crazy stuff, people go, boy, where'd you get that? And I'm like, sadly, that happened. You know? I know what that feels like. That guy feels like there because that happened. But it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, man. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure to meet you, man.
Yeah, pleasure mine. Thank you.
Time enough to figure you out. Time enough to write this down. Wish me luck, give me hope.
wisecrack.